Support for KQED Podcasts comes from Star One Credit Union, now offering real-time money movement with Instant Pay. Make transfers and payments instantly between financial institutions. Online or through Star One's mobile app. Star One Credit Union, in your best interest.
From KQED.
Can I just say, who decided the fact that daylight savings is this Saturday? Really?
Why?
We need this out of all weekends. We need our sleep this weekend. Right.
This is Political Breakdown from KQED in San Francisco. I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on The Breakdown, it's our Friday roundtable. We'll break down President Joe Biden's State of the Union speech. It was an energetic and blunt performance from the president, including a number of direct attacks on his political rival, former President Trump, without ever saying his name, but repeatedly referring to him as my predecessor. Biden opened the speech with an impassioned plea to fund Ukraine aid.
My message to President Putin, who I've known for a long time, is simple. We will not walk away. We will not bow down. I will not bow down.
And here to talk about all of that and more, as they are most Fridays, KQED politics correspondents Marisa Lagos and Guy Marzorati. Hey there. Welcome to Friday. Boy, we need it, don't we? It's been a long week.
Oh my gosh, is this week over?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the president's speech. I think no question going into the speech, the president's age, he's 81, his energy level, his ability to perform on this big stage, such an important moment. And Marisa, I think you got to say he kind of, if he didn't hit it out of the park, he hit the wall.
Yeah. No, I think he accomplished what he set out to do here. Democrats are excited. Republicans are mad. It was not an olive branch speech. That was not the intention. It was really, I think, the opening salvo of the case he's going to make against former President Trump and Republicans all year. And I actually watched it a little delayed. I had dinner plans and I was getting the alerts and it was like fiery speech, feisty speech. You know, I mean, so I think that in that way, it did what he needed in terms of, you know, showing people some energy and this idea that he's down to take the fight.
Yeah. Guy, I realize I asked that question with two baseball metaphors. I guess it's that's what Steve I get for Garvey's covering Steve Garvey all week long.
Yeah, so look,
there's more of that.
I think, you know, Marisa is exactly right. Everything Biden does in the next 6 months has to be viewed through the lens of re-engaging Democrats, right? I would say politically, he's like a patient in the ICU. Until he gets Democrats' heart rate up about the general election, really nothing else matters. And so that's why you think about starting this speech with an issue like Ukraine. That's not what most Americans would point to as the top issue in their lives, or even, frankly, in the country. But it's an issue in which Democrats feel very differently than Republicans and even independents. And so being able to start on an issue like Ukraine, pivot from that to talking about abortion, again, a very good issue for motivating Democrats. You saw Biden kind of draw those fault lines and really on the issue of Ukraine, draw a real contrast with Republicans and put the speaker, Mike Johnson, in a, you know, kind of a pickle there when it comes to the applause politics.
Totally.
I think Mike Johnson, he was really, he was keeping those claps just below the edge of the rostrum as to not appear on the TV broadcast. It did put the Republicans in a bit of a pickle there.
Well, they all night, I think, really struggled. He had given them these marching orders not to react. You know, we all remember during the Obama speech when the senator yelled, "You lie," and that was like everybody clutched their pearls. And for a couple State of the Unions after that, people kind of behaved. And now it's sort of this free-for-all, and I feel like it was this mix last night where Republicans either were sitting there stone-faced, not clapping for things like American jobs, which is like a gimme, or they were heckling. And it was hard to hear on TV, but if you listen to some of the coverage of folks in there, I don't think they were able to kind of do what Johnson was hoping, and neither was he. I mean, he really looked at times like pained, like he didn't know what to do with his face.
He was sort of applauding but frowning. I mean,
yeah,
it was very much
like,
a mixed message.
You could see his shoulders moving because he was clapping under the table.
Contrast that with Nancy Pelosi, you know, standing up with that sarcastic clap that she gave President Trump and then like ripping up the speech. What about Kamala Harris? She was back there as well. This is her, third State of the Union, I guess, that she had to, was there for?
She did her part, I thought, well. She stood up and clapped and, you know, I mean, it's pretty performative. It's not, I feel like in that position, it's hard to mess it up because you're You're just supporting the president.
Yeah. She gave a nice wave to her husband, Doug, as he came in before the whole thing started. Well, I want to play a little short clip here from the speech. And, you know, one of the things that Biden did energetically was to engage at times without a script, I think, and with the Republicans who were jeering. Let's hear a little bit about what he had to say regarding tax cuts.
Oh, no. You guys don't want another $2 trillion tax cut? I kind of thought that's what your plan was. Well, that's good to hear. You're not going to cut another $2 trillion for the super wealth. That's good to hear.
Guy, what do you think? He kind of, it's the same kind of banter that he did last year, which, you know, worked pretty well.
Yeah, I think keep it political. He had no qualms about that. And I know that's gotten some pushback after the speech. Well, you know, this is not supposed to be a political rally.
Speaking of pearl clutching,
the lines have been blurred. I mean, didn't Trump hold the RNC on the White House lawn? I mean, I think we're past the point of trying to, you know, divide. This is not supposed to be a political speech. A political speech is exactly what Biden needed to do heading into last night. And I think that's what you saw in those moments.
Yeah. Well, and of course, you know, Trump gave a speech in front of the Lincoln Memorial as well, which was a lot of people thought was inappropriate given the content of the speech. What about...
It's just like we're still living in two different worlds, though. Can we talk about that? I mean, the things that Trump says and does and gets absolutely no pushback for. And then if Biden, like, I mean, it's like, what is it? Are we in 2000 or are we in 2024?
Well, you know, he was constantly on social media last night, Trump, including a guy you pointed this out to me, or somebody did, like this thing he put on his Instagram account with the filters and the Snapchat filters.
Very presidential.
Very presidential. Oh, well, what about the Republican response? They chose a 42-year-old, the youngest senator in the chamber, Katie Britt, 42-year-old senator from Alabama, who gave a speech in her kitchen. Now, we should say, it's kind of a no-win situation, because you're going from this big speech in front of a big crowd to, in her case, her kitchen.
Which itself was interesting.
But I didn't mind the messenger at all. Look, in this era of geriatric politicians, I thought it was a good choice, honestly, to pick someone who could talk about having a young family, who, you know, talked about living through this era of how expensive everything was. I think the problem was more the message and the lack of solutions, or really offering what is a Republican platform look like, even on an issue like immigration, such a fertile political issue for the GOP. She spent a lot of time criticizing the president, but I didn't hear what a Republican solution or vision
was.
Yeah,
and I thought the delivery was a little overwrought. You know, it was sort of swung these huge pendulums between her smiling and feeling very welcoming and then sort of like almost crying. And I do think it was an interesting choice for both her and the GOP to decide to put her in a kitchen in a moment when, you know, so much of the Democratic message is going to be about reproductive rights and women's rights.
Well, right after Alabama, her state, the Supreme Court struck down this whole, you know, the IVF thing.
Yeah. I mean, and she spent a lot of it talking about a horrific story about somebody who was trafficked by, you know, Mexican traffickers and was raped. And, you know, again, like, this is a party who's putting up a candidate who's repeatedly been accused of assaulting women and was found in court to have done it just in the past year. So, like, a lot of that subtext I just find kind of baffling. You would think that they would want different optics.
Real quick, Guy, the president did talk about Gaza and all the suffering the Palestinians are going through because of the war there, announced a new pier to deliver humanitarian aid. Is that going to, you know, help repair those relationships?
We'll have to see. But that's the kind of, I think that's the kind of message you'll need to focus on, not just in one night, but in many nights and many weeks and months to come.
Yeah, and exactly. And of course, you have to think that the pressure on Netanyahu is going to continue, not just from us.
He had pretty tough words for him, too. And I think, while also underscoring, hey, I have been a friend of Israel. I think that's the message he's going to need.
Yeah, and I think, you know, he is a credible messenger on that, because he has been a very consistent supporter of Israel. All right, we're going to take a very short break, and when we return, we'll take a look at some of the most interesting election results that you may have missed on Tuesday. You're listening to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer. We'll be right back.
Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. Some want it all. SFO wants zero. Zero landfill waste, net carbon, and net energy by 2030. Learn more about the triple zero goal at flysfo.com.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. you'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer. Here with me today, as they are most Fridays, Marisa Lagos and Guy Marzorati, politics correspondents here at KQED. We all were working hard on election night, keeping track of the returns. And Guy, I know you've been tracking the unprocessed ballots number. And there's got to be, what, at least a million, I would say, ballots still uncounted? A big number.
More than, 2.7 million was the number out today from the Secretary of State's office.
Still now, that many.
Yeah, now they're drawing that from all, you know, every county in the state, and the counties are reporting that at different times. So it's a little bit of a moving number. But yeah, certainly still, you know, many ballots left to count. That still kind of puts the state, I think, in the range of that number we've all been looking at, 31%, the lowest turnout to date in a presidential primary in California. But yeah, certainly there's in close races, starting at the top with Proposition 1, all of those ballots left to be counted could make for some interesting watching in the coming days.
Exactly. Marisa, you and I talked to Paul Mitchell yesterday, who is the ballot guru, the voter information guru. And I think we looked, and we should say for transparency, we were recording this around noon on Friday. There was about maybe, 3,200, 4,000 votes separating the yes from the no. Yes, slightly ahead. So it could change. I mean, typically in past years, the later votes were more liberal, more Democrat, younger. But
all those procrastinators.
All those procrastinators.
That is what the campaign thinks is going to happen here. But it's been a weird year in that way, right? There was like sort of, it used to be very consistent, like sort of earlier votes were more conservative and then day of tend to turn more liberal. We kind of had a little of both this time, right? And like it's also, the whole system has changed so much in the last few years in terms of the ability to drop off your ballot and mail it up to election day. So then some of them haven't even gotten to the counties until, now, basically. I think today is the deadline, right? Friday.
Actually, I think Tuesday. Isn't it? If they're postmarked.
Yeah, they have a full week.
Yeah. They get a week. They extended it.
Unless your mailman's riding a horse, I think it's...
the number that come in from now on is going to drop pretty precipitously. But, still a lot of ballots left to count. Well, among the races, of course, that is decided, the Senate race, where we're going to have Adam Schiff facing off against Steve Garvey. And I think, probably with all those ballots uncounted, Garvey might still finish first, I guess. I mean, I think it's at least theoretically possible. I think he was leading in the short seat, the race, that second question to finish out the rest of Feinstein's term. It doesn't really matter. I mean, they're going to have to be, it's going to be one-on-one in November for both of those questions. But what impact do you think, boosting Garvey the way Schiff has had on this election? Who turned out and how things turned out, especially down ballot?
Well, Paul talked about this a little yesterday. If you're interested, go back and listen to that conversation. But I do think, he believes that it may have sort of shifted the dynamic in some of these congressional races, including some safe, blue seats where we would have expected a top two finish by two Democrats.
Including
Schiff's own seat. And instead, we're seeing a Republican. And of course, that's going to be, in some ways, in a safe blue seat, that's good news for whatever Democrat won. But I do think, I think there's an open-ended question in terms of what is the impact of this race going to be going into November, and then how there's open questions like how or if does Garvey campaign? Does he want a Trump endorsement? How do you run a campaign when the math is just not on your side?
Exactly. And Guy, I know you were paying particularly close attention to a race in a district you live in down around San Jose. This is the seat where Anna Eshoo is retiring. Sam Liccardo, the former mayor in first place, Joe Smidian, supervisor for Santa Clara County, in second, with Evan Lowe, the assemblyman, not too far behind. Is it possible Lowe could catch him, do you think? And what do you make of the fact that, those two are in first and second? I mean, they are not, Lowe is, I would say, probably the most progressive of the three.
Certainly. I mean, that's how he positioned himself in the primary. That is a race in which the AP has not called any of the candidates advancing to the general election.
But Joe Smidian did.
But Joseph Midian did. I do think Liccardo, he leads right now. It looks likely he'll end up there. And then we'll be watching that race for second place between Joseph Midian and Evan Lowe. Lowe made up some ground based on the returns that came in yesterday. Midian is still in second place. We'll have to watch that over the coming days. And I think, you know, no matter how it shakes out in the top two, we're going to have two Democrats. That could become a really expensive general election in which you might see some kind of proxy wars between labor and business interest. Liccardo has been a target of organized labor for many years when he was mayor of San Jose. We'll see, you know, how much emphasis, energy organized labor puts into that when, you know, we're going to have a real, on the county board of supervisors here in Santa Clara, a really competitive business versus labor race in District 2 that might end up being where labor pushes more of their money.
And this is just where you see, like, a Sam Liccardo as mayor is going to be a very different type of sort of politician for labor than a Sam Liccardo in Congress potentially, right? He's probably going to vote sort of in that typical Democratic way once you get to a place that is so different than a city hall in the Bay Area.
What will be interesting, perhaps, is if he does make it to Washington, is how will he react to some of the tech questions around AI, regulation of AI, exactly.
Crypto. I mean, but, you know, I think you can look at a Ro Khanna and see how somebody can kind of, like, navigate that in terms of, like, feeling like he's got relationships with tech, but also being basically a good progressive, you know?
Exactly. We didn't talk about this when we talked about the Senate race, but we can talk about it now. But when we talk about the congressional seat that she's leaving, Katie Porter came in third and made some comments about the election that got her in some hot water, I'd say. A lot of pushback from Democrats and also elected officials like former Secretary of State and now Senator Alex Padilla. She said that the vote had been rigged by the billionaires who poured money in to support Adam Schiff and to, criticize her, the crypto, sector, calling her all kinds of things. What do you make of, the hubbub around her use of the word rigged? I mean, she and Elizabeth Warren always talk about the economy being rigged. But in this context, Marisa, it really does evoke what Trump has been saying about the election.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about this yesterday. I think that it is a tough, even if this is the type of language you've been using for over a decade, it just has a different connotation today in the wake of 2020 and the ongoing sort of painting by the right of the election system as not being reliable. And so, yeah, I think that it's also just speaks to, I think, some of the challenges she's had with members of her own party. And we'll have to keep an eye on that. I did, before we go, Scott, want to talk a little bit about a couple races we haven't gotten to.
Sure,
there was two ballot measures in Huntington Beach, that one of which would essentially ban pride flags on city property. Another would require voter ID for local elections. Both of them are overwhelmingly passing. And the state's already promised to take them to court over that voter ID law. This is like an ongoing, I would say, battle between the very conservative beach city in Orange County and the state. The state's gone after them over not building enough housing as well. Any surprises there? It seems like Huntington Beach is keeping its like old school reputation alive.
It is, but I would say that the measure restricting the flying of the pride flag, I see that as kind of an opening salvo for, I think, what we're going to see of a lot of in November, which is gay rights, issues of LGBTQ identity on the ballot. There is going to be a state ballot measure to delete the ban on same-sex marriage from the state constitution, although the courts have long nullified that. And then school board races, right? We've seen this a little bit in the past, but I really think this is going to grow in 2024. Conservative candidates using, trans identity as a rallying cry. And I think we're going to see that up and down the state.
Well, it might even creep into the presidential election a little bit, as President Trump has made that an issue as well, as have Republicans nationwide. So, seeing a little bit of that play out here in California, which is a little more surprising just because we do tend to be a more blue state. But it's a good reminder that there are some pretty red pockets here in California. And I think Donald Trump got more votes in California than any other state simply because there are so many Republicans here. All right. Well, have a great weekend, you guys. I'd say we've probably earned the weekend. Are you going to watch the Oscars, Marisa?
Maybe
guy.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
Check it out. I don't know. It seems like Oppenheimer's got it in the bag. It's rigged.
I'm there for the dresses, let's be real.
Okay, very good. All right, well, listen, have a great weekend. That is a wrap for Friday, March 8th. Political Breakdown is a production of KQED. Our engineer is Seal Muller. Our producer is Izzy Bloom. Our team includes Marisa Lago, Sky Marzorati, Molly Solomon, Otis R. Taylor Jr., and Ethan Tobin Lindsay. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks so much for listening.